You're listening to the official podcast of Asbury University, produced by students with God-honoring conversations that inform, edify, and encourage. This is Asbury. We explore culture and current topics through a Christian worldview, promoting a well-balanced life, and we empower our community to belong, become, and be set apart. I'm your host, Abby Laub. Welcome to This is Asbury.
Hello, I'm Dr. Paul Nesselrode, professor of psychology and also director of the honors program here at Asbury, and I have the privilege of guest hosting this episode of This is Asbury. Today, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to facilitate a discussion with two wonderful guests, Dr. Abigail Favalli. She is a writer and professor serving at the University of Notre Dame and teaching in both the McGrath Institute for Church Life as well as in their Department of Theology. And as a writer, her essays have appeared in several noteworthy publications such as The Atlantic and First Things. Her most recent book, The Genesis of Gender, explores in a systematic and yet also personal way what she calls the gender paradigm, and this from an Orthodox Christian perspective. And my other guest is Dr. Janet Dean, a clinical psychologist who served as a colleague of mine in the Asbury University Psychology Department for about 15 years before she recently migrated across the street to serve as a professor in the Department of Counseling and Pastoral Care at Asbury Theological Seminary. In addition to her commitment to the classroom and her many speaking engagements, Dr. Dean has also authored several important works, and most recently a book entitled Listening to Sexual Minorities, A Study of Faith and Sexual Identity at Christian Colleges. Dr. Favalli is on campus as part of the Asbury University Honors Program Colloquium Speaker Series. While she's here, we thought it would be a great opportunity for the three of us to sit down and talk a bit about some of their recent work. So welcome, Abigail and Janet.
Yeah, good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
I'm glad you guys are both here. So I broke up some questions, some things to talk about into categories, and sort of I thought would be great would be sort of just to get to the ground, to get to the touchstone, the first principles. And so when I was thinking about our time together, I'm thinking about our audience that I think would be helpful for them as they walk through issues related to gender and sexuality, oftentimes within the context of Christian service through ministries, but also within their own family, their extended family, or even in the context of a meaningful friendship. And I also want to say at the front end that there's so much pop cultural level messaging that attempts to pass as insightful and clarifying wisdom, but it really just boils down to a set of trite phrases and memes and slogans, and it's sort of a bumper sticker approach to what is perhaps, given the centrality of our sexuality and our gendered embodiment to our identity, one of the weightiest of all human issues. And so there's just, this is the cultural moment we find ourselves in. And so given that landscape, what do each of you find to be the most important touchstones to stand on for those of us who want to approach these issues from a position that is well-grounded within a Christian understanding of personhood? Are there some first principles that we should simply become familiar, we simply must become familiar with and remind ourselves of when we start to approach these topics?
Yeah, I love this question because I think so much of the confusion in the conversation is often because we're talking past each other and not getting at the root of what we're taking for granted in terms of underlying assumptions. So when I think about the concept of gender and approaching it from a Christian perspective, a few first principles pop to mind, and one would be the importance of our creatureliness. So we are creatures. We're not creators in the sense of we are not responsible for creating the world, right? There's a certain sense in which we have creative action in the world that mirrors God as creator. But in relation to him, we are foremost creatures. So we receive reality as a gift. We receive our nature as a gift from God. So we don't construct reality. And reality exists, right? Reality isn't just a construct of language or culture. but it's a gift that we receive. And part of that gift is our own nature. And so another principle I would pull in would be, it's one of the underlying principles of a Christian anthropology or a Christian theological understanding of the human person, which is to see our nature as a union of body and soul. And I think in our culture, we are very prone to dualism. I think we're very prone to thinking about the soul as this kind of our consciousness, which is this little ghost inside a machine that is our body, and our body is kind of this husk that we inhabit for a time. But the Christian understanding is much more profound in terms of the unity of spirit and matter. So we're not two natures united. Rather, the union of spirit and matter forms a single nature. And so that's what it means to be a human being. And so that means that our bodies matter. Our bodies are integral to who we are. And our bodies are part of that gift that we receive from God as our creator. And so I think in our time, we both were weirdly obsessed with the body, but we think of the body as this kind of object or this avatar that we can kind of construct in order to express an ideal version of ourselves. But I think Christianity actually has a very high view of the importance of the body. And you can see that in many of the central mysteries of our faith, like the incarnation and the resurrection. So I would point to those two. And then I would also say, as Christians, it's so important in this conversation, which is so fraught and so personal, the proper response to another person is always love, right? So part of our faith also teaches that every single human being is made in the image of God, right? And so this conversation is really prone to divisiveness and dehumanizing rhetoric on both sides. And so I think it's really important also to hold on to that reality as well.
Thank you. So creatureliness, union of body and soul, and primary response should be love. Yeah. Janet, how would you respond or add to that?
So I would always start in Genesis 1 and 2, we are created in the image and likeness of God, but it's as male and female that we're created in the image and likeness of God. And so right there, there's something about our gendered self, right, that matters in terms of how we reflect the image of God. And along with that, you know, if I push that then into sexuality, which is dependent upon our gendered selves, when we understand sexuality in terms of I would say the expression of a covenantal relationship in marriage, we then see one of the primary signs that God uses to teach us about his relationship with us as a people. And so there's this theological significance to marriage and sexuality within marriage and gender within that sexuality within marriage, that if we lose one of the I think, primary way that God has taught us how he relates to us or wants to relate to us. And so in that, I would also add that our embodiment matters. I you know, pull that term from science and psychology, where we say that we are biopsychosocial beings. And I think about that. We are a biological system, a psychological system, and a social relational system. Each of those systems is wholly independent and completely interdependent at the same time. And when I think about that, I can't help but think about the Trinity. Our God is three in one. We are three in one. None of those parts of us can operate without the others. And yet they are separate to some degree. We can't separate ourself from our physical embodiment, just as the Father can't separate from the Son or the Son from the Holy Spirit. And I think holding that in mind, and it's that whole being, that biopsychosocial self then that's in a spiritual relationship with God, teaches us something about who we are and how we reflect the image of God in who we are in our daily life. And I think it pushes against some of the modern-day Gnosticism that's out there, even in the church. So I would hold that. And then, you know, we have human dignity. Psalm 8 tells us that we were created a little bit lower than the angels. Some Hebrew experts would say it actually says a little lower than God himself. And then David says that we were crowned with glory and honor by God himself. we have dignity and value as human beings, and that's all human beings, no matter where they're coming from or what their experience is, which leads us to this position of love toward everyone. But together with all of that, I think the other really key first principle for me is we have to understand the reality of sin. And I think in our world today, we don't take sin seriously enough. And when I talk about sin, I don't just mean original sin, brokenness. I also mean volitional sin, those sins that we willingly commit. But I would add to that a community sin, the sin that's woven into our systems and our culture that affect people in ways that they don't even understand that they're being affected. And so when I approach someone, I have to think about the totality of that. And the reality of suffering that comes out of that sin that we live in, and the hope of redemption. And so I want to hold those pieces together with the beauty of our created nature when I work with someone or walk with someone.
Abigail, in your book, you talk about the need to walk beside and accompany, I like the way you emphasize that word, accompany those who are struggling with their bodies. And Janet, in your work, as you talk about the role of social support for those struggling with their sexual identity, you tease apart the concepts of self-acceptance and self-affirmation, which is interesting, suggesting they're not the same thing. So for those of us who are apprehensive about just blanket affirmation, how do we then accompany one another? How do we provide the proper kind of social support and friendship? Can we start with Abigail again?
Sure, yeah. This is a really difficult but also very important question. So a couple of initial thoughts or maybe some helpful distinctions to keep in mind. So one distinction would be kind of distinguishing a person from a framework or a person from an ideology. And I think in our cultural moment, which is one of my frustrations about the conversation, the way the conversation is often framed is that in order to love and respect a person, you have to endorse fully that person's framework. And I don't think that's true in other areas. I think we're able to kind of hold that, that's actually not true in other areas. Like, for example, I think most people would readily acknowledge that it's possible to have a real friendship with someone who is a different religion, for example, or has very different political beliefs. But in this conversation, for some reason, respect is conflated with endorsement. And so I think, and then on the flip side, there can be a kind of negative picture of that where, in order to kind of push back against the framework or to reject the ideology, you have to reject the person. And so I think it's important then to kind of disentangle those. And so as Christians, I think we have to be savvy about philosophical and ideological frameworks that are at odds with the faith and to not endorse those. But also to be willing to reach out in love and respect towards someone who disagrees while still being grounded in the truth of the Christian understanding. So that's one distinction I would want to kind of introduce. And another one would be the distinction between essence and experience. And I think we're going to talk about essence a little bit. So I won't get really into that conversation, but I think one of the mistakes that's being made in the current conversation around gender is to define the essence of a person according to their experience. And I think when, for example, someone might identify, like let's say as non-binary, for example, what's being articulated there is an experience of gender. And I think as a Christian, even with, you know, my beliefs about gender, I can receive that as an experience. And I can't assume what the experience is that's being articulated either, because experiences vary so much under these labels that our culture offers. So I think it's important to have a kind of posture of humility and curiosity about someone's experience, but then to not fall into the trap that because someone has a particular experience of gender, that then determines their essence. So that becomes a way, I think, of receiving someone's experience, but also not mistaking that for an essence necessarily. So those are some initial thoughts to kind of approach the question of relationship. I'd love to hear what Janet has to say and then maybe kind of follow up with that.
I really like the way that you make this difference between essence and experience. And I'm thinking about how can I incorporate that language into some of the things that I'm doing, because I think that's what I think when we talk about self-acceptance and self-affirmation that we're really getting at, right? In a self-affirmation model, what we're saying is, you know, I look at all of these parts of myself and I love every single part of myself and I celebrate every single part of myself. Where self-acceptance says, I look at these parts of myself and there are some of them that I really love and I'm really happy with them, but there are others that, you know, I wish they were different or they're not exactly the way that I want them to be, but I'm okay with this collection. And there's something in our society where our thinking about the self has changed that if I don't celebrate every part of myself, then I don't love myself. And yet we know in relationships, you know, I think about my closest relationships with my husband, with my children, with my parents. I love them dearly, but do I like every single aspect of them? No, nor do they like every aspect of me, but it doesn't diminish how much I value them and how much I love them. And but I think it's that mistake that our experience must say something about our personhood that then leads us to reject one another or feel like we're rejecting one another when we disagree about some aspect of gender or sexuality. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I do. And I think the rhetoric of kind of self-affirmation also, it's important that when that includes a rejection of one's sexual identity, of one's sex as male or female, if that can happen in an understanding of self-affirmation, well, the implicit idea there is that the body is not the self. The body is not part of the self. And so that hits up against one of those first principles we were talking about a minute ago, which is that our body is integral to our personhood. It is who we are. And so I think you can see in that rhetoric of one's true, like expressing one's true self could come at the cost of rejecting one's body. I think that reveals the kind of view of the body that's at work there that we don't want to accept.
Right.
And I like your distinction between affirmation and acceptance because another part of creatureliness is to accept the limits of being a creature and the things we don't like about, you know, having a body that's prone to illness or age or disability or having limitations on our agency in certain ways. But I think part of becoming human and becoming an adult is learning to accept the things about oneself and one's life that we can't control but have to kind of accept as part of our creatureliness. And then also the flip side of that, that there are things about ourselves that we can change. We have a certain agency in terms of growing in virtue and things like that. And so when it comes to avoiding volitional sin and things that you talk about with that, that we're also called to exercise our agency in a way that doesn't just, you know, act on or affirm every kind of impulse that we have, right? We have to kind of sift through our experiences and to be able to act in a way that is in accord with what is true and what is good. I think the self-affirmation model, you know, kind of erodes all of those important distinctions that you're trying to make.
So this leads us a little bit away from the support question, but I think it's really interesting. And I'm thinking about Carl Truman's book as I say this, but that ability to change things about ourselves. And so I think about contraception. We remove the consequences from sexual intercourse. But then I think about makeup and I think about coloring your gray hairs and sculpting your body and all these other things that we can do. In what ways do you think our ability to change some of these, to some degree, just surface levels or the consequences has then led to the gender identity concerns that we see today?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my book, I kind of describe sort of a twofold revolution, I guess, in gender. And a big part of that is conceptual or philosophical, which relates to a lot of what we've been talking about. But another huge stream is, the huge thread is the technological. And so we have the capacity through technology to modify our bodies in ways that are just historically and culturally unprecedented. And so I think that kind of feeds into our objectification of the body and this idea of the body as something, this kind of avatar that we construct. And so in some ways, even though there are certain distinctive things about what's happening with gender, it's very much connected to a broader trend in our society, which is, you know, the desire to kind of craft one's ideal self. And that's, you know, I mean, I think about history of fashion, right? You could think about the Victorian era where the style was to have these, like, to basically, like, for women to have the bodies of wasps, you know, these, like, tiny waists and these, like, big old hips and shoulders. And that impression was made through clothes, right? Well, now it's, like, done through a scalpel, right? Like, on the body itself. Now, I think there's a certain level, like you talked about makeup, right? I think there's certain, there's a difference between adorning the body in a way that kind of draws out the body's natural beauty, that accentuates the beauty of God's creation. And then there's a difference between that, I think, and then actually modifying the body, either to create a certain kind of, meet some sort of cultural sexual ideal, or to try to escape one's nature, right? So there is like a line, I think, that's being crossed there that you mentioned contraception. Like, I think once we're using technology in a way that actually disrupts the normal function and health of the body to achieve some kind of other end, and in some cases it's an aesthetic end, right? That's when I think we're crossing a line where we're kind of messing with God's design and trying to kind of restructure our bodily life in a way that makes it easier for us to kind of fulfill our desires, but then goes against the kind of natural telos or order of the body. So that might be a line you could draw, that some uses of technology that work with the natural telos, like I'm wearing contacts right now, I have terrible eyesight, but that's helping my eyes function as they're designed to function. Right, so that's a good use of technology on the body, but other forms of technology actually can disrupt the body and make it malfunction intentionally in order for some other purpose.
Is this an arrow shooting one, or is this a pendulum? Are there a form of grace in other aspects of human experience that are going to sort of swing things in a different direction, or are we headed in areas of, you know, transhuman, sort of this new, where would you, either one of you want to speculate as to if we're starting to see the negative repercussions of crossing these lines, or is that that's foolish to speculate as to where the culture is headed?
I think there is a pendulum swing that's happening. I think one thing that will shift, and I don't know how long it will take to shift, is the framework that presents these kinds of invasive body modifications as medicine. So I think that is already happening, in the sense that more and more countries who've offered the gender affirmative model, which medicalizes the body in response to gender distress, are doing systematic reviews on the evidence and realizing that there actually isn't high-quality evidence that this helps people. And so there's already a kind of swing away from that model. I think it's going to be messy in the United States because we have a decentralized healthcare system and the professional organizations have been kind of captured in a way that means it's going to be lawsuits, it's going to be messy. But I do think that's going to shift. But what I don't think is going to go away totally is the kind of transhumanist thing that you mentioned, because now that these technologies exist, now that they're on offer, they have in a sense kind of created a demand for them. And so I think what will shift is that it won't be seen as life-saving medicine, but I still think there will be, you know, people who continue to choose these sort of body modifications, and those, maybe it'll be more like they're categorized in like other cosmetic kinds of surgeries. So I don't think that's going away. But I do think we're going to see a kind of shift in the terrain related to gender specifically.
I would imagine many of our listeners would want to hear from both of you on the issue of being asked to use desired pronouns. So this is, who knows what the context is. It could be more intimate, like, sort of a friendship, or it could be some sort of stranger. So I know there's a lot of landscape there, but just How should we begin to even think about this question of being asked when we believe that what we're being asked is contrary to sort of the biological creation that they are? Maybe Janet, you want to start with this one?
Sure. I think this is actually a hard topic for me, and I don't know that I have settled my position. I really don't. I do think to some degree it's an issue of language, right, and that perhaps our language, for whatever reason, is inadequate to capture people's experience. I want to just keep that on the shelf. But, you know, I grew up during the time when the feminist movement was challenging the use of a lot of masculine language. So, you know, we moved from saying mankind to humanity, and we changed all our hymns to be more inclusive. And, you know, I first learned to write using masculine pronouns. And then, you know, by the time I'm in college, we have to use gender inclusive pronouns. And hearing from so many people why that mattered to them, that they didn't feel included with the masculine pronouns. So I have that in my background as I step into this conversation. I know personally it never really bothered me. I felt included when you said mankind. I didn't think twice about it, but I know that that's not the experience of so many people. And so I think about that. I want to hold that over here on the one hand, that somehow our language says something about recognizing the personhood of another. But I also then, on this other hand, hold this language as it reflects some kind of reality that's there that I believe as a Christian I want to honor and always speak to what's true rather than I would say a misperception of reality. There's a part of me who wants to say a delusion, but that would be unfair to call it that, I think. And so the question for me is, do I step in to, from this person's point of view, honoring how they understand their personhood, or do I stay over here and I stay in line with what I believe is biblical truth about who they are based on their body? And so I find that this is one area where I am immediately within that conflict between, I would say, biblical truth about gender and sexuality and a way of hospitality, love, and grace. And so probably where I'm at is my theological position is that we stay with what's true. And so we speak the pronouns that go with their biological self. But my pastoral approach is I meet them where they're at, and I use the language that they prefer. I don't know how to hold those together, but that tends to be where I'm at and what I do.
Could that be, could a resolution there be just the uniqueness of each relationship and the setting in which it's taking place?
Perhaps so. And I can imagine, you know, if I'm part of an institution or an organization or a church where we've decided we're only going to use those pronouns consistent with or congruent with the physical body, then I'm going to abide by that because I'm in a system where we have valued that. We've made this decision. But, if I have a friend, somebody that I know dearly, or a loved one, a family member, and they ask, I am probably going to meet them where they are, at least initially, until we've entered into a relationship where they've given me permission to speak about this. And then I may begin to challenge a little bit. But yet, when we do this, we have to recognize, you know, when a child comes out and they ask their parents to use a different name or to use different pronouns, for that parent, they are losing their child as they know them. And there's significant amount of grief in changing the use of that to meet their child. And I think we have to recognize that, too. Like, it seems like those pronouns are just words, but they carry so much of who we are and our identity that making a choice either way does have, I think, significant implications for what we do. I don't know, Abigail, how do you approach this?
Yeah, this is a question I've agonized about probably more than is healthy for any. And I also feel conflicted. I think you articulated the pain point really well, but just to kind of rearticulate in my own words about the stakes, right? Because language is so important, and there's a really profound connection between language and truth. And so the language that we use shapes how we perceive reality. And that's very true. And you could kind of, an example of how that's true is to look at like authoritarian regimes that manipulate language in order to kind of manipulate people's perceptions of reality. So on the one hand, I think it's the connection between language and truth is so important. And there's a lot of, I think, manipulation of language happening in our culture in order to kind of create a certain understanding of reality that I think is dangerous. On the other hand, language also serves as this really important relational bridge to another person. It's how you communicate. It's how you build trust. You know, it's how you build intimacy. And so I think that's why this question is so difficult, because kind of the dual goods and purposes of language are in conflict or at odds. And so so it's something I continue to discern, but I will say where I currently am is that I think this is something that has to be carefully discerned according to different contexts. And so, you know, you've already kind of alluded to this, but I think it's important to consider one's role and relationship toward another person. So maybe what I would advise a parent of a minor child to do would be different than what I would advise someone in a clinical setting to do with a patient. It might be different, you know, what I would advise a pastor to do when he's preaching from the pulpit to the whole flock might be different than what I would advise him to do in the privacy of his office in a one-on-one conversation, right? So I think it really has to be carefully discerned according to certain contexts and according to one's role or responsibility to another person. Now, I do think that when it comes to young people, to children, there's a certain amount of identity exploration that's very normal developmentally. And I do think it's important for parents and adults in a kind of authoritative relationship with the child to be the kind of guardrails. Because I think there is a risk of concretizing or solidifying an identity that would kind of remain in flux in the normal kind of youthful experimentation. And so that's somewhere where I would say to use caution, to perhaps avoid pronouns, to have a conversation with your child about, okay, well, let's use a nickname for now, but I can't go this far. And in certain kinds of relationship where there is a certain amount of trust and intimacy, you know, I think of like horizontal relationships of maybe adult siblings or friends, you know, I would, in certain contexts, there might be a strong enough relationship where you could actually say, okay, you know, let's talk about how we can use language in a way that honors my conscience and honors your conscience. Like, how can we use language in a way that really respects both of our freedom? And it could be that depending upon the strength of the relationship and the maturity of the people involved, you know, you could come to some kind of agreement there. But yeah, so I think there are circumstances where using someone's desired pronouns are warranted, and there are other circumstances where I think it should be avoided. In general, I avoid pronouns, which is easy to do in a one-on-one conversation with someone, right? None of us have used each other's pronouns in this conversation. It's trickier when you're like talking about someone to someone else or when you're writing about someone. That's something I run into as a writer, that it can be very tricky to do this kind of dance to try to avoid pronouns. But that is one way, I think. That's kind of my default mode. But there might be moments where I kind of discern to step out of that default mode for a specific kind of relational good. But even in those moments, you know, I think it's also important, and this isn't as hard to do as I think maybe it sounds, that what it, like, in order to kind of communicate what using someone's pronouns means and what it doesn't mean, you know, because I think a lot of people would recognize that, you know, just because someone's using my preferred pronouns doesn't mean that they completely agree with how I see the world, right? So, I mean, in my case, as someone who speaks and writes publicly on this issue, you know, if I were kind of in correspondence with a trans person and used that person's desired pronouns, they wouldn't suddenly be under the illusion of what I believe about this stuff, right? Because I'm very open about what I believe about this stuff. So I think in that way, it would be pretty clear that I'm kind of stepping out in terms of hospitality. But again, that's not kind of my default. My default is to try to avoid pronouns. And that's mainly because, you know, I really try to pay attention to what my conscience is telling me, too. And I do kind of run into this wall. Like, I feel like there is something that when I use language that's not based in reality, there's something in me that kind of pushes up against that, and I don't want to just override that all the time. So I think it's a tricky question that has to be carefully discerned.
So I thought, how do I approach this question? I guess I gave us sort of two choices here. Is our genderedness most properly understood as a set of social constructs that sits on top of real but merely biological differences? So we're not, you know, I think we, let's sort of remove that question here. We're talking about real biological differences, but still, is our genderedness just sort of culturally developed constructs sitting on top of that, not much more? Or is there something deeper, I'll just use that word, deeper, that distinguishes man and woman, something that we might call an essence? And if the former, I mean, we can start talking about, well, is there anything that is everything then subject to deconstruction in our quest for justice and fairness? If the latter, then I think my question is, how do we avoid, like, over-applying what this distinction means? I don't know who would. I think I start with Janet. Last time we'll go with Abby and then Janet.
Sure. Okay. So I think when we're talking about men and women, the essence of that distinction is our procreative potential, right? So we have bodies that are organized toward different procreative capacities, and our species depends upon that distinction, right? So it's a very important distinction. It's a very real distinction. There's no human being that has ever come into existence without the kind of combination in some way of those co-generative powers. And the potential exists whether or not it's ever fully actualized, right? So, you know, I have a young daughter. She hasn't gone through puberty yet. So she's not, you know, capable of actualizing her potential for motherhood. But nonetheless, her body is already structured in a way, and her bodily life is already ordered in a certain way according to that potential, right? And so that's a very real thing. And I think that is the fundamental kind of essence of what it means to be a man versus a woman, right? So a woman is the kind of human being who has the potential to generate within herself. Again, whether or not it's ever actualized. So an infertile woman would also be included in this category, because infertility refers to an innate potential that's being prevented from being actualized. And then a man is the kind of human being who has the potential to generate outside of himself, right? And then there are kind of complex ways in which maybe that fundamental difference also kind of creates perhaps like second order sorts of differences. You know, we can talk about other biological factors such as you know, kind of hormones and other things that can affect certain traits that might manifest more prominently on average in one sex or the other. But there I'm a little more cautious, because we're also both fully human. And so the full range of kind of human capacities and traits are also open to both sexes. So when I talk about sexual difference, I stay pretty close to the body, right? And then the further we get away from the body, the more, I guess, skeptical I am about, you know, kind of drawing lines about this is what femininity is, this is what masculinity is. And I think there are, so I think that's the fundamental reality. That's the kind of the fundamental essence, sexual difference. And then every culture has a way of expressing this reality, because it's so fundamental to human existence. So there are different cultural expressions of what men and women are or should be. And I think we can have and should have conversations about whether or not those are good, you know, certain ones, right? Because I think some are beautiful. I think this is a reality that should be expressed in art and beauty and fashion. And it's something that's a beautiful feature of our humanity, right? But there are also kind of cultural expressions that have been harmful. You know, you think of like female genital mutilation or foot binding, and or even the wasp kind of costumes of like whalebone corsets, right? So I think there are ways in which we can have conversations about how certain constructed expressions of sexual difference might not be good. And we shouldn't mistake the constructed expressions for the reality itself. which is, I think, what's kind of happening in our culture right now, which is that we are kind of seeing, you know, in certain understandings of gender, it's the constructed expression is what creates the kind of illusion that there's an actual underlying essence here.
I really like the way that you talk and think about this, and it's helped me to make sense of how I, where I guess I ground this essence difference between male and female in their physical body and this reproductive capacity, whether or not it's actually realized. Mm-hmm. And as I think about that, and I think about us being biopsychosocial beings, I think that that reproductive essence shapes our bodies, but it also then shapes our experience of the world. Yeah. And so we, because I am in a female body, I experience the world differently than somebody who would be in a male body. And I do think that to some degree that begins to shape the way some of perhaps my traits or some of those behavioral expressions. But society also probably plays a much larger role in what that then looks like. And so I want to hold in tension that my biological reality does shape the way that I engage and I experience the world and who I become, but it's not limited or determined by that by any stretch of the imagination. And so I think that essence is more than reproduction, but I don't know how much more it is than reproduction. I think that's a question that I'm still wrestling with. And so, but again, I think just in my life, kind of, you know, being raised during the feminist movement and kind of this move toward including women in ministry and other careers, and hearing how our nature has been, we've decided that men and women are equal, and that means there are no differences between them. I want to push back against that. And I want to say, no, that's not true at all. But I'm not going to push back enough that I'm a complementarian, where I think we have a certain set of roles or a certain set of, I just don't believe that. I believe that the Spirit freely gives gifts to whomever the Spirit chooses to give them. And so any of us could have any constellation of giftings or personality traits as God is deemed to give to us, and as our experience has contributed to. You know, and so my culture is going to play a role in how I come about as much as anything else. And so I think if we hold all of those things together, I think we begin to see how some of the gender expressions come out, but we're also not limited to say men can only be like this or women can only be like that. And I'm actually concerned in today's world that it seems like our understanding of what it means to be male and female, at least our gendered selves, has actually become more rigid than I remember it at any point in my life. And I'm looking at that saying, how did we go from moving to this place where, you know, we were pushing against those stereotypes to equality back to stereotypes? And but I think it's because I think in our efforts to say that men and women can have this whole range and expression of giftings and abilities and personality traits and that sort of thing, the only way we've been able to make sense of that is to forget that there is an essence difference between who we are. But I don't know exactly how we've come back around then to the stereotypes. Do you have some insight into that?
Yeah, well, I think once you uproot manness and womanness from the body, the only thing left to keep those categories distinct is stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's part of the shift that's happened. We no longer think about men and women fundamentally as, you know, the capacity for motherhood versus the capacity for fatherhood. I think that used to be much more intuitive to most people living in past historical times. Like that was the fundamental basis of the distinction. But because we've kind of used technology to bracket that part of our nature in a way, I think that has shifted the ground of what it means to be a man and a woman to things that are much more about aesthetics, that are much more kind of the kind of artificial aspects and what's stereotypical, right? So, yeah, I totally agree. We're in this sort of strange time where, you know, if you have a girl who likes certain toys or activities that are normally associated with boys, she's invited to kind of question whether or not she's really a girl at all, which to me, I agree. I'm like, that's so regressive. This is something I try to instill in my own children, which is to kind of build in them the intuition that, well, I'm a girl because of the kind of body I am. And I'm a boy, you know, I'm a girl because I could grow up and be a mommy one day. You know, I'm a boy, I could grow up and be a daddy one day. It's not because you're a girl because you like My Little Ponies or Pink, right? And when my kids say things like that, I'm like, no. You know, like, you know, there are boys who like Pink too, you know? And there is this incredibly rich individual diversity that's already always, that's also part of God's creative design. I think the way the conversation has been framed is, you know, to get away from the idea of overly restricted roles and stereotypes. You know, we've kind of veered in the direction of there are no real differences. So I think what we have to do is kind of step into the tension where differences exist, but they don't translate into these rigid universal roles, because there's also incredible variety among women and among men. I mean, think about, like, how many women have ever existed in the course of human history. Like, billions of women have existed, and no two of them are exactly alike. Like, that's mind-blowing, right? So there is this incredible richness and diversity within womanhood and within manhood, even though the category of man and woman still holds true. Yeah.
Mm. I want to thank both of you for not only this that last question, but the entire time here, your ability to carefully and with insight and with quality help us to start to put particular vocabulary and particular ideas to these questions. And I guess before we finish, I just want to ask each of you, in addition to thanking you for your time, just if you could tell us just briefly what you're working on now so we can be anticipating what the future holds.
My research team, Mark Yarhouse of Wheaton College and Steve Stratton of Asbury Seminary, myself, we just finished a national study looking at sexual and gender minorities and their cisgender heterosexual counterparts at both Christian schools and public schools. So I'm in the process of analyzing that data. We're hoping to get that published here pretty quickly. So that's one big thing that we're doing. Another thing that we're working on is looking at the role of self-acceptance, self-compassion, and grace to self, and the role that they play in the mental health of sexual and gender minorities. And how are those things the same? How are they different? So we're looking at that. And probably the third project that I'm looking at is with a fellow theologian. He and I have been talking about it, Chris Bounds. We've been talking about working on how do we better understand the essence of maleness and femaleness and what that means. And so hopefully we'll be able to get something out around that. So those are the current projects
okay.
I'm doing.
Exciting.
Wow, that's awesome. One project I'm wrapping up on, which has been going on for like a year and a half, it's been a big thing and sort of a new type of medium for me, is working on a podcast, but it's like a finite series of episodes, a documentary style, like an audio documentary basically, that includes a lot of a lot of interviews with Christians who experience gender discordance, and then tries to kind of provide formation on this issue, but in a way that actually humanizes the issue and kind of tells the stories of our brothers and sisters in Christ who've had this experience and how they've found God in the midst of that. So I'm excited for that to come out in the coming months. I wrote my first novel, which will come out this year, which was fun, to kind of dust off my sort of fiction writing. And then I'm just starting a new book project where it'll be similar to The Genesis of Gender, in that I'll be kind of analyzing different paradigms of sexual ethics on offer in our culture, kind of the secular consumer paradigm, then the purity paradigm that's often offered in some conservative Christian circles, and then contrasting that with a kind of sacramental sexual ethic. So apparently I can't stay away from really hot button topics that I just gotta like wade into the fray, you know, and So I'm just starting work on that now.
That's all very exciting. Do you have a title for the novel that just is going to be released here?
Yeah, it's called Our Lady of the Sign.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. At least they haven't told me that I need to change it, that's what I chose. Anyway.
A huge thank you to both of you for your time, for your expertise, and your willingness to share it with us and to give us the benefit of all your scholarly work. And many blessings to both of you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Too. Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This is Asbury. To learn more about Asbury University, visit asbury.edu.